Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ever since the first human set eyes on the Mississippi River, the power of the river has helped to build and destroy human settlements and cities. It has served as a source of life and food and a highway. It has also gripped imaginations, launched amazing journeys, and inspired music, art, and literature. Paul Schneider is one of the most recent writers to fall under the thrall of the Mississippi. His latest book is Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History, and he is with me now. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Those of us who grew up in Iowa, we don't have to read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn to fall in love with this river. We see it, we cross it, we see what it can do when it's flooded, and it's really such a part of our culture here. But you live in Massachusetts, so what drew you to this river?
That's true. I do live in Massachusetts, but I grew up, there's a lot of things drew me to this river, but I actually, and even though now I live on the coast, which I love, I grew up pretty much very close to the Connecticut River, actually not that far from where Mark Twain moved once he made enough money to go back east and hang out with his friends in Hartford. So I grew up next to the river. It is obviously no Mississippi River, but it's a good-sized river, and I had all my friends and I, the very first thing I ever bought was a canoe with my own money anyway, and my friends and I used to bike down to the river and just I had river dreams from very early on. And my mother grew up down in St. Louis, and so we had some cousins there, and she would talk about the river. And my dad grew up in Wisconsin, so I sort of have Midwest roots. Actually, the first book I ever pitched, which I was unable to sell, was about a river. I was at that point more infatuated with the Missouri, like a lot of people, perhaps, because of Lewis and Clark. I don't know why. Because of Lewis and Clark and whatever. So anyway, when I started talking with my editor about writing about a river, it just was obvious, pretty obvious from the beginning that the Mississippi is the river to write about. And then the book became, it also became obvious to me anyway, in the course of researching it and writing it, that you really, as wonderful as the Mississippi is, the upper Mississippi is above St. Louis, you really can't tell the whole story of the river's role in America without also talking about the other major tributaries. So the book is actually also about the Ohio and the Missouri and the upper Mississippi and, of course, the big river below Cairo.
And, you know, it's not hard to find pictures of the Mississippi River watershed, but I'm always astonished by how big the watershed is. I mean, how big is the Mississippi watershed?
It's crazy big. I mean, it's basically everything between the Appalachians and the Rockies with a few little minor kind of trickles that head north or south or you know, at the edge of Texas and the edge of Alabama. But it's about 41% of the country. So it's you know, and it drains. Gee, I should have the number right off the top of my head, but it's half the country basically. And what's interesting also is that the upper Mississippi, you know, which is what is sort of called the Mississippi above St. Louis, sort of has the pride of name, and it's the original river, and that's the name that we use for the whole river. But it's not the longest tributary, and then which is the Missouri, and then the Missouri. And then the Ohio, which is also very storied, brings the most water to the party. So the three of them are like these three equal kind of creators of the big river. And they all represent, to me anyway, a very different branch of American history as well. So it's kind of a cool story. But it is massive.
Well, and a lot of people who have told the story of the Mississippi River in history start with the native people who lived near the Mississippi and in this area. You go back even farther. Now, yeah. the Mississippi River actually predates humans?
Well, sure.
Right? I mean, and it predates the Ice Age?
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, the glaciers?
Yeah. It predates the Atlantic Ocean. And, I mean, at least the the eastern half of the river. It didn't look like the Mississippi, but obviously before the Rockies rose. But the New River, which is ironically enough named, is probably the oldest river in the world. So it's very old. And for me, there's something really cool, to not use a very clever word, about knowing how the land is actually formed, in addition to knowing just the human stories.
Well, we talk, of course, in Iowa, the glaciers brought us this amazing soil that makes Iowa what it is.
But yeah.
I guess I'd never looked into how the Mississippi was formed, and to think that that predates all of that as well.
Right. The Mississippi, particularly up here, up in Iowa and in the northern half, was very affected by the glaciers. I wouldn't want to suggest that it looked like the Mississippi today. You know, in some ways, like when I'm talking about that, what I say is, you know, parts of the Mississippi are older than the Atlantic, and parts of it are just being made today or disappearing today,
right,
in the case of Louisiana. So the glaciers really did play a huge role, basically, in damming up rivers that used to flow to the Hudson and diverting them down south. And essentially, also, you know, the really wide, beautiful valleys of the upper Mississippi. Because the upper Mississippi is, ironically enough, well, Twain says it cleverly at the beginning, you know, it's a river that's wider at the top than it is at the bottom. And that's also partly because of the glaciers, because there was this massive lake that was bigger than all the Great Lakes that was dammed up behind the ice. And then when that finally broke through, it carved out this immense valley through which the Minnesota River in particular comes through, a valley that the Minnesota River could never, even this spring, with all the rain, the rivers up here could not have carved the valleys that they flow through, which were made by these kind of diluvian floods after the Ice Age. So the Ice Age is very important.
Now, of course, when you read the white man's history of the United States, you start reading about the French explorers, mm-hmm, that traveled the Mississippi. But there were many people who lived in the watershed and closer,
yeah,
to the Mississippi before that. And some really remarkable cultures that rose and fell that we really don't know that much about.
We don't know that much about them. Although some people know a remarkable amount about them. I mean, one of the things I love in doing these books is I read these kind of crazy studies of, you know, people who count how many shards or sherds or specks of pottery they find that are colored this way, and they can, it's like people who read the tea leaves. I mean, they're convinced, they can divine an incredible amount of information about these cultures. Obviously, most of it's lost, but it's really fun for me to sort of pore over scientific archaeological things and kind of find the nugget, you know, that is for me the most telling. But so it's oddly like the archaeologists, they're combing through the dust looking for an arrowhead, and then I'm combing through their articles about arrowheads looking for, you know, whatever I'm looking for. But they do know quite a lot. And one really cool thing about the Mississippi watershed and the Mississippi Valley is that it's one of, I think, three places in the world, or four maybe now, that it's pretty well agreed among paleontologists that agriculture developed all on its own, separate from Mexico, separate from obviously the Europe, you know, the Euphrates and the other places. And that's a fairly remarkable achievement. I mean, to think that there's something like that happened only in three places or four places. And so the cultures are very old, and the things they built, these sort of landscape architecture that they periodically engaged in constructing are just beautiful. And eerie. You know, most of them are gone, but it's you know, you can go down to Cahokia, or you go up to Wisconsin, or even in Iowa, you go to the Effigy Mounds. And then there's 8,000 years of history of, and it's kind of like myelin landscape architecture. You know, it's very modern in some ways, too.
Well, you visited Effigy Mounds on your journeys. Could you read us just a little bit of that passage?
Sure. I'd love to. So this was early on when I was talking with my editor and we were developing this book idea, and one of the early decisions we made was that it was not going to be a book about my journey
down a river from top to bottom or any specific journey. But because one of the things I love about doing these kinds of books is being able to travel all these places, I still said, well, look, I'm going to go to all the places I want to go, and I'm going to go see as much as I can. So I went up and down, you know, the river all over the place. And in this part of the river, I actually was discovering mostly by on land, not so much on the water itself. And I came over to the Effigy Mounds. Taken together, the Effigy Mounds of the Upper Mississippi Valley were the largest scale collection of sculpture of any kind in the world. More than art, though, the landscape of the Upper River Valley was the spiritual expression of a civilization that left almost nothing else behind in the way of material artifacts. Many of the mounds contain a few graves, but there are plenty of effigy mounds with no burials associated with them. The graves that do occur seem almost incidental, a juvenile here or a few bodies there, so that some have suggested they may have been people who merely happened to pass away during the season of mound building. More telling, they were not buried with the kind of ornaments and other goods that connote either a high level of social stratification or a strong belief in a material afterlife. The mounds have a meaning of their own, seemingly separate from either the social structure of the builders or their burial practices. But what is that meaning, and where did the mound builders go? After 500 years of effigy mound construction, the practice simply stopped, more than stopped. Sometime before AD 1300, the people of the Effigy Mound region abandoned their sacred landscape altogether. For several centuries after that, the archaeological record for the heart of the Effigy Mound region is a total blank. The people, it seems, were gone, and the forest returned over the mounds that were not on the prairie, and the grass grew thick again on the paths around those that were.
That's Paul Schneider reading from his book, Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
The Calliope is quiet now. The rudder's thick with rust. The main deck and the paddle wheels are covered thick with dust. But Granddad's in his glory, still standing on the bow. Halo round his pilot's cap, and I can hear him now.
Parkway, Parkway, it's 2 fathoms deep below. Parkway,
Parkway,
hear the gangplank start the show. Parkway, play those banjos as we go.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This hour, we're talking about the Mississippi River, its history and its lore. Paul Schneider is my guest. He's the author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. And Paul, just before the break, we were talking about your visit to Effigy Mounds in Iowa, mm-hmm. which, of course, is one of the remnants of one of these ancient civilizations, the mound builders, that we really don't know that much about
right.
how they lived and where they went. You were reading an excerpt from the book, but you go on to write about what you felt when you were visiting Effigy Mounds, and you were pretty much alone.
Yeah,
that's
a funny story, sort of, because I'm kind of a sucker for mounds. I mean, I love them, and I stop whenever I see any like little sign, you know. And I was kind of in a rush. I was on my way home, but I saw the sign, and of course I knew of the National Monument. I was like, I gotta go. So I pulled over, and it was kind of near dusk, and I just started walking around. That's just naturally what you do when you get up there. I mean, I assume that's what the Native Americans who built them must have done, but it's reflexively what any tourist who goes up there who has any sense of, I don't know what.
You kind of walk around them.
You know, they seem a little too, you know, I'm not a druid or anything, but they seem a little too sort of sacred to somebody to walk around on top of. So I was just walking around, and I started walking around, and it was towards the end of the day, and the only other car there was the ranger. And so I also knew that they were going to kick me out. Anyway, so I started walking around this bear. There's one of them that's just this incredible array of bears. And I walked around the first bear, ho-hum. Then I walked around the second bear. And then I guess, for whatever reason, just kept walking around the same bear for a while. And then all of a sudden, I don't know, it was getting dark, and it's really beautiful, and but it's getting darker. And all of a sudden, I just got this feeling of, like, bear, you know, like this essence of bear. Of course, there are any bears there. Probably haven't been in a long time, but I was like, okay, time to go. And I just took off before Mr. Ranger could find me, you know.
Right,
so it was like
right,
Yogi.
With the hair standing
yeah,
up on
was,
the back
you
of
know,
neck.
I kind of walked myself into some kind of trance, you know, and I'm not normally that sort of whatever.
Well, you as you go on to write about the mounds, you also write about the fact that not just the mounds, but there are other big erections of earth that were built along the Mississippi and we're still doing it today.
Well, that was the ironic thing. I kind of ultimately, because if you travel the Mississippi very much at all, of course, you see levees everywhere. And then the greatest mound of them all is the Serpent Mound over in Ohio. And somehow, yeah, it seemed like the levees in particular, but all the sort of big constructions of dirt piled up. And then weirdly, the mountain, like if you go to Cahokia, which is the biggest mound in North America, you know, there's even a bigger mound of trash, you know, from the St. Louis dump. That's basically this, you know how those modern dumps look. They've got that same sort of pyramidal shape and they've got grass growing right up them. And it was just interesting how, to me, it was sort of ironic and interesting how basically there's something about the landscape that, you know, makes us want to pile up piles of dirt, basically. So anyway, that's probably a little bit, you know, I don't want to be disrespectful of the mounds to compare them to the dump.
It's you move through history, you have an interesting perspective on the interactions that the Native Americans in this region had with first the Spaniards and then the French. And of course, you know, histories are written by the victors. So we do tend to see these stories from a very one-sided perspective. I got the impression that you wanted to try to bring a little bit of balance back to those stories.
Well, I did, for sure. I mean, but while it is true that if you lump all Europeans together as the victors, the history is written by the victors, but the survivors of the DeSoto expedition, who are the ones who told the story of getting, you know, chased out of the Mississippi Valley by the natives, you know, were not the victors in that case. And they were, and it's really interesting, actually.
Even though they left so much behind that they damaged that
they
culture.
They left a lot behind, the damaged culture.
Right.
Sure, yeah, for sure. Diseases and pigs and horses, you know, which maybe didn't damage the horses, probably didn't as much. But it is interesting that the Spanish, who we think of as being having these spectacular successes against the Aztecs and the Incas and these far more, every word is tricky nowadays, but these what we consider to be far more stratified and developed native cultures of Central and South America, three big armies came up here. Some of these guys were guys who actually had participated in defeating the Aztecs. You know, they were with Cortez, and they just got their behinds. They got shown the door by the Mississippian natives. So those groups were very powerful in their height of their powers. And I do want to tell that story. And it's an interesting, you know, it's a complicated story, particularly later when the English start to come in down through the Ohio Valley.
Well, and the French, too. I mean, you talk about the Spaniards coming with their armies. The French didn't come with armies, but because they didn't, they almost were more damaging to these cultures because of the way they infiltrated.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, for sure, to the degree that disease and to a lesser degree, invasive species, pigs in particular, that were notorious for destroying native gardens. To the degree that those things weakened the Indians, you know, to the point that by the time Europeans actually were physically encroaching on their land, they were in no real physical condition to
defeat them, then the French really did bring, were the harbingers of the destruction. But the French program was always much different than the English that followed, in that the French, for whatever reasons, were not as much colonizers in the sense of coming in and building towns and taking over land and farming. They tried it down on the Mississippi. They wanted to, but it never was as successful as their sort of far-flung trading, you know, fur trading operations, which really did transmit disease to every corner of the watershed.
Right.
But it's really when the English start to come in with African Americans too. It's important to remember that, you know, there were basically slaves and free blacks who came from the very, very beginning. I mean, came with the Spanish, actually. But so, you know, we tend to lump everybody into one of these three categories. But it's important to remember that Africans, they weren't even African Americans at that point because they were straight from Africa, that Africans, you know, also played a huge role.
Right. The Mississippi River, of course, really was a highway. I mean, and that was some, it was a great way to travel for Native Americans. It was a great way to travel for the French.
Mm-hmm.
But you also write about the fact that it didn't go where the French wanted it to go. It didn't go where the English wanted it to go. And they tried really hard to imagine that it really was going to get them to the Pacific.
Yeah, that's an amusing part of the French in particular. You know, they kept discovering these Great Lakes and these beautiful Great Lakes. But they really wanted to get, basically, find a Northwest Passage or find a way to out to the Pacific. So the earliest French explorer, official French explorers, were specifically coming down, Joliet and Father Marquette, and they were specifically hoping that the river, or at least hoping to determine whether this river that the Indians of Wisconsin called Mississippi went to the Pacific. And it seems so absurd to us, but if you look back at the maps that the Spanish had left and at what anybody knew, nobody had really seen the Rocky Mountains. Well, obviously Native Americans had seen them, but no Europeans had been north pretty much of where, like the Grand Canyon, where Coronado's guys were. But the Spanish had been around the bottom and had been up to where the Colorado River comes out on the Pacific in the Sea of Cortez. So they knew there was a river that came out on the Pacific. They didn't know whether it was, you know, so it wasn't as crazy as it might seem to us. Like, we're like, what? Duh.
It just fly over in a plane and look at it, people, right?
And that's also sort of remarkable just to think how little they knew.
Right.
They had no idea the Rocky Mountains were there.
Right. Well,
or the Sierras.
And they're out there. They're out there in a canoe pretty much by themselves.
Yeah.
You point out that Joliet and Marquette didn't make it all the way to the Gulf.
No. I mean, it's funny because they got far enough to, they were afraid of running into the Spanish. I mean, these guys were really brave guys considering what they did and that most of the native groups.
Well, it's amazing that they got as far as they did without getting killed.
Yeah. Which is testament also to the difference between the French program and the Spanish model, in that they knew six native languages between them, or seven, you know, from being fur traders and from being missionaries. You know, one's a black robe and one's a fur trader. And so they knew a lot of native languages, so they were able to, and their descriptions of the Iowa Indians are just beautiful. I mean, it's very cool stuff. They finally got far enough south to know for sure that it was going to the Atlantic. I mean, going to the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
And they figured, well, we don't want to get caught by the Spanish.
Let's
turn around. We'll go back. So they turn around and go back. And then on their way back, interestingly enough, because they had come down from Wisconsin, they'd come over through Green Bay, which they called the Stinking Bay, and they'd come down that way. And then they're going back up, and their Indian guides are sort of like, well, where do you want to go? And they go, well, we want to go home. And the guide said, well, why are you going back to Wisconsin? You can take this right turn on the Illinois River and go to this place we know called Chicago, and it's really close to the lake. And that's how Chicago gets discovered. So it's very cool stuff.
It's amazing. I'm talking with Paul Schneider. He is the author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. And let's talk a little bit about the role that the Mississippi and the watershed played in the lead up to the American Revolution. You write about what King George was saying about the Mississippi River and about westward expansion. And that was very much at odds with what the people who would come to be known as Americans wanted.
No, it was one of the things. I mean, of course, you know, when I embarked on this journey of a book, I obviously knew the Mississippi was full of myth and full of Mark Twain and full of Americana. But I really didn't have as good an idea, perhaps because I grew up, you know, in New England, and what an important role the watershed played, the competition for the watershed played, you know, not only in the American Revolution and the American revolt against King George, because he did say at one point, you know, we're not going to have any more settlement over the Appalachians. And that's kind of one of the intolerable acts. They're like, what? You know, no surveyor. I mean, George Washington was a surveyor. We all know that. They're like, what? No surveyors going over into the Ohio Valley and the Mississippi? I don't think so. And but even before that, I mean, we were talking about the French, but the valley, the Mississippi and the Ohio, particularly the eastern half of the Mississippi, so the Ohio side, were what the French and the English were competing about too. So the fact that all these places with their pretty French names on the Mississippi River now speak English was also about that competition for the river.
Right, which of course went on after the Revolution.
Continued after the Revolution, although not for
1812.
Yeah, although not, you know, but the 1812 it's almost like the end of that competition because Napoleon had already sold it to the Americans. So had the American in 1804. So had the Americans not defeated the British in the War of 1812, it's quite likely that the British would have taken back New Orleans and would have taken back Louisiana. You know, and who knows? They might be Canada now.
Right.
And I'm not going to say anything that would offend any Canadians about that, but all these things are in play.
Right.
You know, and they all come down and it's really interesting. Well, George Washington, his like very first taste of battle is way up on the Ohio River, on the Monongahela, really. But I mean, basically, a little skirmish that starts the Seven Years' War.
And really, the Battle of New Orleans sort of puts a period on
yeah.
this struggle. But you also go on to point out, after talking about the Battle of New Orleans, these wars, and you described them as wars, with the Native Americans, which we sort of lump into one big history of westward expansion. But you go through and you actually delineate each of these different conflicts.
Yeah, I mean, it's startling. I mean, and it is important to remember, I think, you know, that basically it was a state of constant warfare. It was a big, big, ugly process. And that's not to say it was all friendly, peace-loving Indians who were getting, you know, there was a lot of bloodshed on both sides and a lot of injustice. But it is, we often do sort of think, oh, well, you know, the Indian Wars ended around the time of the Civil War and that's that. But they, in fact, you know, went right, well, depending on who you ask, they, you know, go right on up to Leonard Peltier being in jail still. I mean, you can go all the way to whatever, Wounded Knee. But the last kind of actual, it's surprising because you would think it was out west or somewhere, but the last kind of really officially recognized battle between United States forces and Native American forces is up in Minnesota on the top of the Mississippi. So it's you know, it's a constant struggle.
And this river and the rich land around it was really at the core of so much of that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not always a pretty story. I mean, and you know, the flip side of it is below St. Louis, it's also the story of slavery.
Right.
I mean, it's really the story of slavery too. So
and the river played such an important role in that. I mean, race on the river and what this river meant to African Americans who were traveling up and down as slaves, trying to travel up to get to freedom. Being sold down the river.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's interesting. And the river meant something different for everybody. You know, the Ohio River is sort of the River Jordan. That's the one you had to get across to be free until at least the Fugitive Slave Act. You know, and then the Mississippi for the Indians was also the river they were being removed across. So it's a boundary for them as well, because all the eastern tribes were, Jackson started kicking them out and moving them over.
you know. But so it is a sort of like there's the dark side of American history on the river. But it's also where the blues were born, where jazz was born, where rock and roll was born, where country music was born.
We'll dig into that more in just a moment. We need to take another break. I'm talking with Paul Schneider. He is the author of Old Man River, the Mississippi River in North American History. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
We look down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them beating on the drum. They stepped so high and they made the bugles ring. We stood beside our cotton bales, didn't say a thing. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Old Hickory said we could take them by surprise. If we didn't fire muskets till we looked them in the eye. We held our fire till we see their faces well. Then we opened up our squirrel guns and really gave them well. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah, they ran through the briars and they ran through the brambles and they ran through the bushes where a rabbit couldn't go. They ran so fast that the hounds couldn't catch them on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This hour, we are talking about the Mississippi River. My guest is Paul Schneider. He is the author of Old Man River, the Mississippi River in North American History. And just before the break, we were talking about all of the great things that came from the river. We were talking about some of the very difficult, hard things about this river and what it meant to African Americans in this nation's history and Native Americans. And right. There were a lot of ugly things that happened in this part of the country. But the culture of the Mississippi is so interesting, too. And I almost wonder, you write about how, you know, the Mississippi River obviously was used to travel up and down and more often down than up, but to transport goods, to transport people. But it was really pretty difficult to get to from the East Coast. So there was this culture of the Mississippi that was kind of isolated.
Yeah, I would say that I think that's accurate. I think it was isolated, but it was also remarkably cosmopolitan. And the Mississippi was this place where all of these cultures, which were all musical, mixed and ran into each other and collided in a way kind of like a mashup. And music was the only real kind of entertainment. So every night, you know, the descriptions of the boats, they pull up because they didn't travel at night back then, unless you were crazy. You know, you'd pull up and
crazy even to travel during the day, I think.
Yeah, but and, you know, the fiddles would start and, you know, and there was one study I saw where I can't remember the exact number, but it was the number, somebody went, like some Alan Lomax type person went in around the turn of the century and counted all the different fiddle tunes in Arkansas. And there was just something like 750 named fiddle tunes. You know, so all of those musical things collide and come together and ultimately wind up in New Orleans. So that's really where a lot of these musical traditions come from. But even the very first, we were talking at the beginning of the interview about the descriptions of the the Indians along the way, the Native Americans, and they all were incredibly musical. And then there's Africans being brought from everywhere. So it is more than just coincidence, I think, that pretty much up until almost, I would say, somebody will call in and say, that's crazy. But almost up until hip-hop, all the real branches of American music have their roots somewhere in, and hip-hop probably does too, but I'm just saying it's not considered that it was born in some town on the Mississippi.
And it's not just music.
No,
either.
No, it's not just music.
You write a little bit about the panoramas, and that's something that a lot of histories of the Mississippi talk about, these panoramas that were painted of what the Mississippi River was like, and then they would travel around from theater to theater. But these were tremendous and beautiful works of art.
Yeah.
So there was this idea of taking a landscape, painting it to preciseness, you know,
yeah.
and bringing it to people who couldn't travel there.
Right, and scrolling it by
right.
like a film.
Right,
you know? And
right.
Those things were amazing. It's unfortunate, of course, that none of them really have survived. But, you know, they all claim to be longer than the last one. Like,
right.
this painting is a mile and a half long,
right.
which is impossible. But, you know, but people did go in and you know, and they were very allegorical. So they'd tell this whole story. And even, of course, Twain is the pinnacle of the literary part of that story. But there were other writers who were also inventing and telling stories in a kind of vernacular language, which he usually is given the most credit for, justifiably. Even before there were sort of these Western cowboys, there were these river guys who were kind of these heroes, Mike Fink and Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, you know, and that whole sort of myth of American frontier language is invented out here on the river.
And some of the wildest towns anywhere were on,
yeah.
on the river as well. And we're not just talking about New Orleans. Davenport had quite a reputation
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, Davenport did. St. Louis was crazy. New Madrid had you know, apparently, you know, raucous parties. Because a lot of times what would happen, particularly before the steam era, is boats would end up traveling together because they're all floating down at the exact same speed and the exact same current, and they would all tie up. So, you know, nightfall could come, and if one of these rafts of 40, 50, 60, 150 boats all show up at some town and everybody tumbles off looking for
a good time at the same time,
yeah, it could break loose. So.
So you became infatuated with this river and with this area. You took many trips that mm-hmm. that you write about in the book. But give me an idea of the kinds of travels that you took on the river itself.
On the river itself, I took a number of, like, as I said earlier, my editor and I early on agreed that this wasn't going to be my trip from Minneapolis to New Orleans or, you know, Lake Itasca or whatever. But I was going to travel around and do as many little, some big, some smaller trips as I could. So I wandered the river quite a bit. And but the primary sections that I did, and I did a number of day paddling trips up north and up in Minnesota and Wisconsin and down here. But the primary, I'm kind of lazy when it comes to paddling. I mean, I've done a lot of paddling, and I actually wrote a book about sea kayaking. And so the river, as probably most of your listeners know, is pretty well dammed up above St. Louis for the most part, as are the main tributaries. And so in terms of being in a human-powered boat, I kind of wanted to be below St. Louis. So my son and I set out. This is one of the first trips we did, and did about 300 miles just from St. Louis on down below Cairo in kayaks. And that was like really whet my appetite. And then I did another couple of sections also in kayaks further down, canoed the Bayou Teche, which is the sort of height of the Zydeco, heart of the Zydeco land in Louisiana with an old buddy of mine. And then I took a small aluminum boat all the way down the Ohio to somewhere below Memphis. So that was the biggest trip. And I had a little outboard motor because the Ohio too is like a lake for much of it. So you know, and then there were about a dozen little side trips and a lot of driving trips and
right.
cycling. I did everything. I really struggled at the beginning of this book because it's such a huge, big, muddy, winding topic, and I was like, "What have I done?" You know. And so I finally said, "Look, well, at least I can legitimately say this is my job. I'm going to go out and do all the traveling I want to do on the rivers." Which I didn't get to do all the traveling. I still have more to do. But that kind of broke me through. And that's partly it's very important for me, putting travel in. That's why I'm interested in history. I wish I believed that leaders learned the mistakes of history and didn't repeat them. I mean, you know, that old adage about, you know, being doomed to repeat history. But for me, it's much more about I find I enjoy the present world more the more I know about the past. It's like a baseball fan. But it's like a baseball fan who knows the game and knows all the players is going to enjoy the game more than the neophyte. So history is sort of like that for me. The more I know about a river, the more I love going and traveling on it.
Well, we're running out of time. So I would love for you to read just a little bit more, but maybe just two paragraphs here from Take Us Onto the River and give us a little bit of that experience.
Okay, great. This is about a section. This is about that section of the river below below St. Louis. So, and we were paddling. The most common sound on the river is the surprisingly loud complaining of the water when it drops over and around the various contrivances of the Army Corps of Engineers. There may be no dams across the Mississippi below St. Louis, but there are thousands of other manipulations installed over the years as part of the effort to keep the channel open to barge traffic. We had been advised before putting in to wait for the river to drop below 15 feet at the St. Louis gauge, which would have brought most of the groins and revetments to the surface. But we were happier with a reading of 18 feet because the higher water covers the miscellaneous rock works, giving the visual impression of a free river. What's more, the quickening drop over the structures, followed by the clot of whirlpools and eddies, and are interludes of adrenaline, which is to say, they are fun. The water was not so high, however, that the long sandbars at the downstream ends of islands were covered. Late in the afternoon on most days, we pulled our boats up on a likely point and spread a large tarp to serve as a first defense of sorts against the thin layer of Mississippi mud that lay caked over virtually everything. We pitched our tent and gathered firewood for a small fire that served more for atmospheric purposes than warmth on the long summer evenings. Books came out of dry bags and a journal, but mostly I found it difficult, even after a long day spent on the water, to take my eyes off of the river. It slid by us on both sides, leaving the odd impression at times that the islet itself might be moving upstream, as if we had pitched our homes on the stern of a cosmic canoe headed north.
And on that journey, that was Paul Schneider reading from his book, Old Man River. On that journey, you, like Marquette and Joliet, didn't make it quite to the mouth of the Mississippi, but you did make it there.
I did make it there.
And you write quite a lot about what the river carries, because, of course, there's so much soil that washes away in the Mississippi River. And I loved one of the quotes that you shared in the book that boatmen say that the Mississippi's too thick to drink but too thin to walk on. And you, speaking of things that the river carries, of course, there's also a lot of pollution that gets carried down into the Gulf of Mexico. And you arrived at the mouth of the river at a moment of a huge environmental disaster.
Yeah, it was startling. I mean, I got there. That was one of the first places I wanted to go, see the mouth of the river. And I had decided I wasn't probably going to paddle that 95 miles or so below New Orleans. We think of New Orleans as being the bottom of the river, but in fact, there's another 100 miles before you get to the mouth. And there's one last town down there. And I booked my room down there because I was going to go down and just try to find somebody or rent a boat or borrow a canoe or whatever and try to get down to the mouth. And then sort of 2 weeks before I left or so, BP, you know, broke their hole in the bottom of the Gulf. And there was just this, you know, the oil spill
began. Right, when the Deepwater Horizon.
The Deepwater Horizon exploded. And so I got down there and it was crazy. I mean, it was, I was lucky to have a hotel room. I was basically, people like, you know, Anderson Cooper were like, how'd you get a room? And I'd say, well, I was lucky. I booked it before he didn't actually say that, but I mean, I was sort of rubbing shoulders with the entire, you know, global media crowd. And I was basically a book writer, but I did get on out to it was very depressing scene to see, you know, all these little shrimp fishing boats heading out, you know, just trying to do their best. They were loaded up with whatever the Army Corps and the various cleanup crews had told them to take out, you know, to kind of build barriers and try to sop up. I mean, it seemed like a Lilliputian effort. I mean, fortunately, so far, knock on wood, the Gulf hasn't died, but the implications are still there. As far as pollution in the river, I mean, it was also an ironic twist because typically, it is the river that's polluting the Gulf of Mexico, not the Gulf of Mexico that is contaminating, you know, the bottom of Louisiana.
Right.
So it was an odd reversal on that front too. The river's way cleaner than it was 50 years ago in terms of industrial pollution, but in terms of agricultural pollution, primarily, you know, runoff, which is what they call non-point pollution, because it's just hard to find. You can't find a pipe and
plug it up, right, like the bad old days of industrial pollution. It's still pretty bad.
There's still a dead zone the size of Connecticut.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it's not good. But that being said, I would say, you know, and the Army Corps has the environmental story is not great on the Mississippi, but that should not dissuade people from going down or whatever their local stream is and enjoying those waters. I mean, that was the other interesting thing about a lot of the travels I did on the smaller rivers, even, is how much our towns have turned their backs in some cases, sometimes for historical reasons, sometimes for flood control reasons. You know, there are towns down there on the Mississippi that you wouldn't even know that they were river towns if you didn't, you know. My son and I would like sneak in over the levee and people in town were like, what? As if the river weren't there. So
interesting.
So everybody should pay attention to the rivers.
So you had this intimate experience on the river. You even swam in the river for a few terrifying seconds, you write about.
Yeah.
But how did this journey and your personal exploration of the river change your feelings about the Mississippi?
As a historian, or, you know, in terms of the story of America and the story of our nation, I learned along the way and wrote about exactly how huge a role the river played in the founding of the country, in the development of the country, and in, you know, and even today in terms of, to the degree that we're still, you know, primarily a agriculturally exporting country, that's all the Mississippi. In a more personal way, that's a very good question. But I think, again, it gets back to a little bit of what I was saying earlier about how I think the more history people know of the place they live, you know, and I'm lucky because I get to have as my job, I get to travel down rivers and learn their history. But the more people know of not just the political history, but the environmental history and the cultural history of their piece of the world or places they're traveling to, the more likely they are to really enjoy them. I mean, the more I knew about the rivers, the more I wanted to go back and see more of it. And I think that that's the important thing for me anyway.
And the more we'll care about the future.
Yeah, and the more we'll care about the future, for sure. I mean, we could have a whole hour about everything that needs to be fixed on the river. You know, but I would say another interesting thing that changed a little bit. This was more from the trip on the Ohio. You know, because I basically, like many of us probably, you know, come from a default position as an environmentally aware person who's concerned about the pollution, concerned about the degradation and all, I was kind of awed by some of the industry along the river, the heavy industry. You know, I know in the bad old days it dumped its pollution into the river, but it is also the story of the people and the amount of labor and work and stuff. It's not as rusty as the Rust Belt makes it sound, and it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of clanging and giant, a kind of Walt Whitman-y, wow, way, particularly if you're looking up at, you know, some giant factory from a small boat. It's just like, whoa. So anyway, so I just love the whole thing.
Paul Schneider, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much, Charity.
Paul Schneider is the author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Thanks for listening.